The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Audrey Roll. I happen to be a librarian for the city of Philadelphia's Free Library. I'm going to first ask that you take a moment to turn off your cell phones. So if you brought a cell phone with you, while we count to about five, could you please go in, turn it off. That's some interesting music from up here. To hear everybody's cell phones go off. Are we done? Thank you. Okay. Oh, I want to remind you that taking photographs is not permitted. I think there are also, you'd probably have to ask permission to do any kind of recording also. So you don't want to take pictures for sure. Thank you all for coming out to our author's event this evening. It's a cold evening to be out. The Free Library of Philadelphia has been the host of these events for 14 years now. Upcoming guests, if I may tell you that from the start, will be Michael Eric Dyson. He'll be here February the 13th. And Nikki Giovanni will be our guest on March the 1st. You may go to our website to find out more information about these events or pick up flyers reminding you of that tonight. But I guess you know because you're here. Our guest is Walter Mosley, who will speak tonight and then be interviewed by Andy Kahan, who is the Free Library of Philadelphia's Director of Author Events. After he speaks and in the interview, Mr. Mosley will sign books upstairs in the lobby. Walter Mosley is the author of over 25 critically acclaimed books, and his work has been translated into 21 languages. Two movies have been made from his work, including the 1995 TriStar release of Devil in a Blue Dress, starring Denzel Washington and Jennifer Beals, and Always Outnumbered, Always Outgunned, which was produced by HBO NYC and Polamar Pictures. It starred Lawrence Fishburne, Natalie Cole, Cecily Tyson, and Bill Cobb. His short fiction has been published in a wide array of publications, including The New Yorker, GQ Esquire, USA Weekend, The Los Angeles Times Magazine, and Savoy, just to mention a few. He's won numerous awards, including the Annisfield Wolf Award, the Penn American Center's Lifetime Achievement Award, a Grammy Award for his liner notes accompanying Richard Pryor and It's Deep Two, the complete Warner Brothers recordings. He received the 1996 Black Caucus of the American Library Association's Literary Award, an O. Henry Award, and he was honored by Robert Redford's Sundance Institute with a Risk Taker Award for both his creative and his activist efforts. He was given an honorary doctorate by the City College, where Mosley created a new publishing degree program aimed at young urban residents, the only such program in the country. Mosley served on the board of directors of the National Book Awards, the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, the Poetry Society of America and Trans Africa, and is past president of the Mystery Writers of America. Let us welcome Walter Mosley.
Comfortable here. I think in order to get a flavor of the book, it would be helpful if Walter read a couple of pages just so you know what kind of book he has written here.
Anybody read this book yet? Good. You know, it's a very graphic book about. It's not about sexuality, the book, but it's about a journey, a sexual journey that somebody takes. You know, I find it very interesting. You know, because nobody has any trouble when somebody has a violent journey, you know, or somebody has a depraved journey, you know, which is, you know, highly unlikely. It's highly unlikely to have a violent journey. Usually you get stopped, you know. And, it's, you know, and you can be depraved, but, you know, it's not all that interesting necessarily. But everybody has sexual journeys. But they don't seem to like me to remind them of that, which I find very funny. So, you know, the beginning of this book starts as a character. You know, there's a black man. His name is Cordell Carmel. I'm going to give a little setup, all right? Cordell Carmel. Cordell's 45. He's black. He lives in the lower part of Manhattan. He's a translator, but not like a translator like Dante or some stuff like that, you know. It's like if you had a vinegar company in Italy and you had a little booklet explaining your vinegar, he would translate that into English. You know what I mean? He's like, he doesn't have a great job. It's just a kind of a job. He has a girlfriend, you know, and she lives in a nice apartment, and he visits her. Now, he's just happened to have met a woman, a young woman, whose mother wanted to hire him, and she's very lovely, and when she says goodbye, she kisses him like, you know, he's a young white girl, and she kisses him like just right here, like, you know, right at the corner of the mouth, you know. This girl has been to Darfur. And she has pictures of people in Darfur. And Cordell knows a guy who could, you know, help her maybe get these pictures in the galleries. And she, the young white girl, wants to help the children of Darfur. Cordell, on the other hand, doesn't know where Darfur is. My black male hero. Now, he's just had lunch with her. And he hadn't told his girlfriend that he'd had lunch with her. And he feels guilty, you know. She kissed him, you know, next to his lips. And he feels guilty. And he had a lot of water. You know, your tongue goes dry when you feel guilty. He had a lot of water. He has to go to the bathroom. And he knows his girlfriend's out of town. So this is how it goes. I had the key to Joelle's apartment. The doorman knew me by sight. She was across the river meeting with a boutique jeans distributor from Newark. I'd go upstairs, do my business, and then call her cell phone and ask her to guess where I was. That would assuage my guilt by letting her know that I was still in town. Robert, the day man, wasn't at his post at her building on 91st and Central Park West. I loped down the hallway toward the third bank of elevators and took car number 16 to the 23rd floor. Joelle had inherited her apartment from her grandmother, who'd died 12 years earlier when Joe was only 20. It was a big place. The entrance area led to a hall that came to a sunken living room, which had large windows that looked out over the park. I loved staying at Joe's place. I was happy that I hadn't made a move on Lucy. They were so silent that I almost walked in on them. Joe was sitting on the top of the back of the couch. Her black blouse was pulled up to her armpits above her breasts. Her black pants were almost off, except for the bottom leg, which somehow clung to her left ankle. John Fry wore only a gray silk T-shirt. He was standing there between her legs, teasing her sex with his erection. She was staring into his eyes, her copper-brown hands gripping his pale white chest and left shoulder. He looked as if he were concentrating on something inside him. Maybe he was holding back. Maybe he was playing with her. They kept that game for some time. I noticed that he was wearing a condom, a red one. For some reason, the color made me angry. At times, he'd enter her deeply. These were the only moments that she made any sound, a kind of moan that came out as, oh, and now and then a, please don't. I wondered almost idly if she would tell me later that she tried to stop him, that she told him no. After a while, I turned away because I couldn't seem to think while watching them. Looking down the hall toward the door, I knew that I should go. There was no benefit by confronting them. John Fry was bigger than me in every way, and I had no weapon with which to hurt him. And, after all, Joelle was not my wife. We stayed together often, but it was her apartment. I decided to leave. I walked down the hallway toward the door. I had made it through the front door and took the first three steps down the hall when Joe emitted a loud, pain-filled scream. I hurried back down the hall and into the apartment without thinking. It was almost as if I had forgotten what I'd seen before. All I could think was that my girlfriend, my lover, was in pain. When I got back to the vantage point onto the living room, I realized my error. Jo was on her stomach now, on the floor, and John Fry hovered over her, pressing down slowly with his hips. I could see the red shaft pressing deeper and deeper into her rectum. He was whispering into her ear words that I only heard as a rumble. She was nodding vigorously, saying, "Yes, yes, oh yes, Daddy. Daddy." I made it to the hall again. Again, there was a shot of ecstasy. But this time, I pushed the elevator button and took the car number 18 all the way down to the first floor. "Hello, Mr. Carmel," Robert, the doorman, said as I approached his desk. There was a wary look in his eye. I could tell that he knew about Johnny Fry and Joe. He was her doorman. Every Christmas, she gave him a $200 tip. He wasn't going to burn that bridge. No, sir.
Anybody surprised about what they just heard from Walter Mosley? Yes? No? No? Well, I'm wondering if the book came as a surprise to you.
Well, you know, it was kind of a surprise. You know, I just finished a screenplay for my book, Little Scarlet, and I was writing it, you know, and I realized I had to be serious about writing a screenplay. You know, I often don't take screenplays seriously, and that's not a good thing. So and my best writing is in the morning. So I was writing in the morning on my screenplay, dutifully. And it was terrible. I mean, the writing was terrible. I was hating it. You know, because it's, you know, screenplays are not art in themselves. They're kind of like plans, you know, for somebody else to make into art. And so in the afternoon, what I would do is I would have this little, like, handheld, like, Palm Pilot or something like that. And I'm going to write a little novel. But, like, it's not a real novel. It'll never happen. But I'll just do that in the afternoon so I won't feel as if I'm, you know, completely out of the... And I started writing about this guy, you know, and this beginning, you know, this is the first few pages happened. I went, wow, so what else is going to happen? You know, like, and you know, there's a thing about, I mean, I'm very literal in this book. I mean, I believe that I should be literal. The next thing that happens is, you know, he doesn't know what to say to his girlfriend. And when he finally comes back, he thinks he's going to break up with her without telling her that he knows. But the minute he sees her, he starts having sex with her. But the minute he starts having sex with her, he realizes that she's putting him in all the positions that he saw Johnny Fry in. So he's somehow cuckolding himself with himself. You know? And he still can't tell her. He can't bring himself to tell her that he knows. But she's saying, well, come on, let me sit on the back of the couch. Come on here, I'll lie down on the floor. You know? And he's like, damn. And he kind of likes it, you know, because it's, you know, it's a kind of like an exponentiate sex. And then that's when I began to realize, I said, yeah, you know, if, you know, a lot of people talk about existentialism. You know, I've been having all kinds of troubles with reviewers. One of the reasons I was really excited about coming here tonight to talk to you guys is because all these reviewers, they talk, you know, people in universities act as if they own intelligence. And really, they don't. You know, they'd say, well, you know, you're just a popular writer. And I said, well, what was Homer? What was Shakespeare? What was Dickens? Who was Mark Twain? They weren't popular writers? I mean, and everybody at that time thought they were popular writers, you know? And so, you know, the idea of talking about existentialism, you see, they'll talk about existentialism like it's in a university, like you can't understand it. But we all have existential angst. And that existential angst is a very pedestrian kind of thing. And so I began to understand, well, here's a guy looking for meaning behind, because, you know, the problem is with the girlfriend is that not only is this his girlfriend, it's his only friend. Like many people in America, he's absolutely alone without this woman. He can't tell her he knows, because then he will have, you know, in his anger, he'll just, like, you know, lose himself. And so his sexual, you know, explorations, which get more and more intense. This is like the mildest part of the book. It's very mild compared to the rest of the book. It gets really intense, you know. You know, the kind of sex that, I mean, damn. I tell everybody, I say 20% of the prose is more explicit sex than I've ever had, you know. And I'm sticking to that story. You know. But you know, so
people
so there,
want to know.
So there I was. I was in a position where I could say, here is a real existential moment, which is also goes just, you know, parallel with the midlife crisis. Midlife crisis and existentialism are very close. And, you know, most people don't write about that. But, you know, I don't get reviews like that because, you know, people don't want me to be. They want me to be a popular writer, and they want popular writers to be unimportant. So.
Well, it seemed like a lot of the reviewers didn't know how to handle the book, period. That you were jumping genres again,
yeah,
and that is something you do and do well, and they just, you didn't fit into the box. So they didn't know how to respond necessarily.
Yeah, I honestly believe that nobody's written a book like this in English. I don't know other languages. But in English, I don't think there's another book like this. I mean, I keep on trying, you know, there's Miller, but Miller's not like this. And there's an A.S. Nin, but again, those are actually, they really are erotica because, you know, it's one, you know, thing to get you excited after another.
So is there a difference for you between pornography and erotica? Well, and know, if so, what is that?
Well, you know, pornography and erotica, the truth is they're about the same thing. The difference is that pornography originally was a word that meant the lives of prostitutes. That's what it originally meant. But then it later became writing and pictures that cause sexual titillation. Same thing about erotica. Writing and pictures that cause sexual titillation. And, you know, listen, there's some things, you know, I mean, really. Cordell is not titillated at first about seeing his woman and this white guy in this room having better sex than he could ever thought about before. You know, there are a lot of moments in this book which I think many readers would say, and many readers have said, I would want that to happen to me.
But I would or wouldn't?
Hmm?
I would or wouldn't?
Wouldn't. And a lot of people in this room, I mean, a lot of people in this room, you know, I mean, I'm not asking you, I'm not going to ask you to raise hands or anything, but, you know, have had and do have sexual experiences that they wouldn't tell anybody. They don't even want to tell their partners, but they can't help it, you know. Because sex is a very personal and private thing. But writing, I mean, literature, is to get into, you know, the experience of a time. If you're going to write about America today, you're not going to write about how crazy sex is in America today, then, you know, it's like writing about, you know, it's like writing about Rome, you know, with no sex. You know, it was all sex, Rome, you know, from
all
Caesar on.
All sex?
Huh?
All sex,
a
Rome?
A lot of sex, man. It was
and
like,
that's
you know,
why the civilization
sex
fell,
and vomiting,
folks.
And, you know, they had their things that they liked to do. You know, a couple of executions, a couple of gladiators.
Well, speaking of Rome, do you see this as a hero's journey? I mean, is Cordell on this midlife existential journey, and is it heroic?
Well, I only write about black male heroes, and one of the things about being a black male hero is to see ourselves in lives that we've been kept out of in the public eye. You know, Cordell is, you know, he's not like Shaft, you know. But, you know, even if you're not Shaft, you still want to have sex, you know. You would like to have a girlfriend who likes you, you know. You would, you know, there's a moment, and there's a few moments in this book that I really love. And at one moment, Cordell is reading an email that his girlfriend is writing to Johnny Fry. And she's about to say to the Johnny that she loves him. And she says, I was about to say I love you, but, you know, love is the most common thing in the world. Everybody up and down the street has love. You know, everybody you meet in every city, everywhere, all through time, have been in love. Love is a bland thing. It's a banal thing. It's an everyday thing. What we have is something special because you know what I need.
Well, but she seems to be without love, too.
Huh?
Well, she seems someone who, by the same token, is really in need of love, and that's what she needs from Cordell.
Well, yeah, love. She needs the love from Cordell. She needs that kind of bland, banal, everyday kind of, I need you to love me. But when she gets together with, you know, when Johnny Fry, you know, she hands him the strap that she's been keeping for 30 years, and she says, are you mad enough to beat me with this thing, motherfucker? You know, and he said, yeah. Yeah, whatever you say, you know. And you know, this is an interesting thing because this is a notion. This is who we are, you know. In a way, it's not the only thing that we are, you know. But the denial, the level of denial, and I want to understand really, there is no denial from black people. I haven't had any trouble with black people. I'm in trouble with black readers. I haven't had trouble with black media, you know. And it's unusual for me, you know, because you know, like I'm kind of like you know the darling of the like you know kind of white literati kind of thing. As long as I'm writing about you know E.Z. Rollins and you know. Things that, you know, things that people feel, well, you know, that's what black people do. Yeah, but you know, but when we begin to hold on to, like, you know, our own sexuality, and that sexuality, I'm not trying to remove it from everybody else's sexuality. You know, Cordell, I have sex with everybody. You know, with you know, Latinos and with whites and with, you know,
he's multicultural.
Yeah, he's multicultural. He said, whoever want to do this with me, you know, and he does stuff that, you know, he does stuff that we do that we never talk about. You know what I mean? You know, it's like, you know, you don't want to start mentioning. You know, you said we had sex, it was really great, but you don't start talking about real details. You might talk about a detail, you know, that everybody mentions, but, you know, when it gets down to the speciality of love, and everybody, you know, every couple, people getting together, have specific, you know, they have needs that, you know, go beyond the realm of, you know, what's, polite parlor talk. And, you know, but this is not a polite parlor talk kind of book, you know. But, you know, it's so disturbing to people, which I you know, you can interrupt me whenever you want.
I will eventually. Keep going.
It's so disturbing to people, you know. Like, I don't know if you people usually read book reviews. I never talk about book reviews, by the by. Anybody who's ever seen me before, I don't even care about them. But I've been reading these book reviews, and people, like, read my book, and they get so upset, they say, well, there's no plot to this book. You know, but I mean, I just read you the plot. He came home. He saw his wife with this other woman. Now he's going on this journey to find himself. That's a plot. You know, in a literary novel, that's a plot. And in a mystery, it ain't going to work. But this is not a mystery. You know, it's a plot. And, you know, and you think, I never even heard anybody talk about plot in a book review before. Most book reviews don't know what plot is. You know what I mean? If I told you, asked you, most people in this room, what the difference between story and plot is, you wouldn't be able to tell me. You know, it's a very technical thing.
Well, let me follow up on that, because did you have an ultimate, did you know the end, like you might with a mystery, or did you have a plan in mind for Cordell once you saw what was happening to him on the page?
Well, I knew that there had to be a twist. The book starts off, I'll read it to you. The book starts off because, you know, it's, and this is how I started writing the book, and I didn't know anything other. I didn't know what it was going to be about. I didn't know anything, but I knew this. I said, I decided to kill Johnny Fry on a Wednesday, but it was a week before that I was given the reason. I'm almost embarrassed about my decision to take a life. It was so pedestrian, really. Now, I knew that that both had to happen and had not to happen. I knew that there had to be a split, that he decided to kill Johnny Fry, and Johnny Fry had to die. But how that occurred had to come from somewhere else, another kind of anomaly in our society and culture. And I didn't know what that was going to be.
Until you wrote it.
Yeah, until I got there. It was lots of fun writing this book.
Yeah, the fun is the journey,
folks.
It's
fun writing about sex. If you guys want to write about sex, it really is fun, you know. But you have to, like, tell the truth. That's really hard. It's really hard, especially for men. I want to say, there are hardly any books written either by or about heterosexual men that talk about how those men feel about having sex. They have sex.
That are fiction
they
or
dominate.
Non-fiction?
And fiction, either. It's like, you know, how it feels to be having sex, how it feels to come into sex, how it feels to, you know, to either dominate or to be dominated or to do things that are very uncomfortable and very strange and alien. And men don't talk about that stuff. Not heterosexual men.
Roth is the only example that comes to mind. Roth, something like Portnoy's Complaint, although that's heterosexual self-sex for the most part.
Yeah, right. And indeed, a lot of it is kind of, it goes into humor and this other stuff. This character is very serious about, you know, what he's doing with these women, and their response to him is, you know, it's very clear. You know, you can have a very explicit talk with somebody you don't know very well, you know, and, you know, but you come with your spouse and you say, well, you know, I can't. You love your spouse, but you can't get to that place, you know. This to me was a very interesting, a very challenging book, you know. And I've been disturbed that so many people, you know, like one guy said, well, you know, it's not about race. He talks a lot about colors, but it's not about race. But here I got a black man, you know, with, you know, the 45-year-old black man with a 22-year-old black woman, the black woman, a white woman, the white woman is trying to save Darfur. And the black man said, I'm trying to get a kiss on the side of my cheek. You know, this is such a real situation, and it's such an incredible political statement. The other thing is I wrote this book, and about 4 weeks later, after I turned it in, that newspaper, USA Today, had an article that one out of every three people in America don't feel they have a friend that they can confide in. And a lot of this is about not having friends. I even put a friend line, like a, you know, that you call up. You can call up a friend, dial a friend, you know. And the guy who runs the friend line says that one of the biggest problems in America is melancholia, which is true. You know, all of this is political. All of this is political, but I got a guy because, you know, there's just so many, you know, engorged penises and, you know, and anal penetrations and all kinds of things that he couldn't even think about it, you know, which I guess is a success in a way.
In that?
Huh?
In that how?
Well, you know, that you can actually write something that upset somebody. You know, I've never been crazy about Rushdie's writing, but it's interesting to write a book that make people want to kill you. You know what I mean? It's like an interesting thing. Well, people want to kill you. Damn. You know, that's a...
That's not a situation you want to be in, but it's interesting.
Well, it's not a situation you want to be in, but it might be a situation that I would want to have been in. You know, I mean, it's an interesting notion, you know. I mean, you know, that writing should have an impact on people. You know, you read a book, you know, you pick up, you know, Philip Roth, whoever, and you're reading this book, and you say, oh, that was a very good book. That was a very important book, you know. He said some very important things. Man, fuck you, you know. You know what you're talking about. It was an important book. Did you go to sleep after you read the book? Yeah. Well, then it wasn't an important book, you know.
Well, important books are generally the domain of nonfiction, right?
Huh?
Important books are the ones that move people. Think of Common Sense, Tom Paine, things that initiate revolutions tend not to be fiction, they tend to be nonfiction.
Well, no, I think in the 20th century, later 20th century, you're right. But there are a lot of books, I mean, books of fiction, books like, almost any of the Shakespeare tragedies, you know, once they were published, Moby Dick.
But I thought you were sort of talking that had some real social response to them.
Well, I think that Moby Dick is like, you know, one of the deepest, you know, I mean, it took, you know, 100 years for people to realize
right.
it. But he was actually, the great white whale was Europe, you know, and it was like, and what was happening, you know, how the world was being destroyed. I mean, we're still realizing Moby Dick today. I mean, maybe a lot of people don't know that, but, you know, but I agree. There's a lot of nonfiction, but that might tell truth. You know, but yeah, I'm shocked. You know, I'm like shocked. You know, like two books that I really love: All Quiet on the Western Front and Night by Elie Wiesel. You know, you got two books: All Quiet on the Western Front. It is violence from the first page to the last page. People getting shot, people getting killed, people getting gutted, people getting gassed, people starving to death. You know, and you got this one guy, Kotensky, gets away with everything. You know, he's like that, you know, Remarque's mouse. You know, he does everything, he gets away with it, and even he gets killed at the end. You know, it's everybody dies. Everybody dies. That's what the book should be called. Everybody dies. You know, and then you have Night. You know, which is a gorgeous book, you know, which is about depravity, which is about, you know, torturing and murdering and like just rending people and tattooing them and killing them and burning them and stacking their bodies up high. People read these books and it's okay. You know, one guy is like, you know, sticking his red erection into this woman's, you know, rectum. And it's like, oh man, I can't read that.
But Cordell has that response too, doesn't he? It's like,
well, Cordell's
he sees
upset.
That and then he's
yeah.
off.
Well, he's very upset. But the idea that a reader can read about somebody getting their head chopped off, you know, is, oh, what happened to the second person they hung in Iraq? Oh, it popped off. His head popped off. You hear that? You know? He said, oh, yeah, last night, you know, I was with my girl, you know, and we decided we'd have a little anal sex, you know, and, excuse me, that's a little bit too much knowledge. But you don't mind about the guy with his head popped off. So, well, that's okay.
Well, why do you think that is? I mean, we know this exists in our culture, but so how do you diagnose it? And then... What does it mean?
You know, I can't diagnose. One of the things is I can only stand up against it. I said, listen, this is what you do. You don't chop people's heads off. You know, you're not in a concentration camp in Germany. You know, we support in concentration camps at this very moment, but we refuse to recognize it. You know, we refuse to talk about it. We refuse to recognize it. We refuse to understand it. And so all I'm doing is I'm saying, well, here, this is human. My character's human. He's alone. He's living a life that's completely empty. One of the things that happens in the book, you know, he never goes back to his job from the beginning of this book, he never goes back to his job. His life has kind of, in a way, fallen apart. He's looking for an answer to his life through sexuality because he feels forced by, you know, what he's witnessed. But he doesn't know how he's going to find his life. And I think that a lot of us are there. A lot of us are like, you know, we're lost. We don't admit it. We keep it quiet. Every once in a while, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, we wake up and we think we're lost. Say, that's why we keep that whiskey in that little place. Say, well, yeah, I had me a drink of whiskey. And it was okay then.
Is sex the answer?
Huh?
Is exploring your sexuality in these sort of, let's say, extreme forms the answer?
Not the answer, but it's one of many things that, you know, to think about. Because you see, in this book, because a lot of people say, well, this is a pornographic book, this is an erotic book, this is about... I'm also talking about a guy who never goes back to his job, who changes his job, who begins to question himself, who doesn't actually ever really figure out where Darfur is, but he understands that he doesn't know and there's a problem there.
Right.
You understand? That I'm talking about the baby steps that the everyday working man and woman take toward understanding themselves in life, you know? And it's, you know, I don't know. I'm really amazed. I was very happy to come to Philadelphia and have this talk because it seems to me that, I'm shocked by people's incredible response to, like, you know, me, you know, talking about, you know, you feel like you're a little kid. So, ooh, I saw her nipple, you know. Ooh, you know. And, you know, and I've been reading things that people call erotic, you know. I mean, really. And I said, but that's not erotic, you know. I don't think mine's erotic either. I just think mine's very literal, you know. Very literal. This is what do you do when you have sex? How do you feel? Why did you get there? Because you got there from an emotion. You didn't get there, you know, by mistake, you know. You got there because of emotion, something you're feeling. And the feelings aren't always love. Very often they aren't love. They're about, you know, but they're about other things. They're about other needs that we have that, you know, that need to be explored. And I don't know. I'm shocked. You know,
well,
really, shocked.
To touch on that theme, yeah. Exploring these emotions, I mean, it seems like at least some of the major characters, Sisyphus, Joel,
mm-hmm.
Who else? Sasha. These people that Cordell has these extreme experiences with, or lustful, emphatic, intensely emotional, these are all people who have experienced abuse, mm-hmm. and sexuality seems a salve for their pain.
Right. Yep, abuse is rampant in America. Lots of people experience abuse. Lots of people have abused people, you know. Lots of people have gone through some really, you know, kind of hard sexual knocks in their early life, and they're working it out in all these kind of odd ways. And so to talk about, you know, Joelle, who, you know, who's badly abused by her uncle, or to talk about Sasha, you know, the character Sasha has a boyfriend, and one day she comes home and she finds her mother having sex with her boyfriend, and she's like 16, 17. And so she screams at him and yells at them and then runs out of the house. And she's just outside sitting there crying. And, you know, but they thought she's left. So they start having sex again, you know. And, you know, and there she is. And so from then on, she started seducing her brother. That was her response, you know. And you know, this is not unusual. But, you know, it's things we don't talk about. It's not unusual, but it's things we don't talk about. And I realized writing this book, a lot of people really like the book. And the book is going to do very well. But a lot of, you know, there's a lot of, we would like you to be quiet about this. All this talk about sex is just too much. You don't really have to say it. I'm saying, but if sex is what's bothering the guy, you know, I write a lot of books about people killing each other, man. I just finished the new E.Z. Rollins novel, man. Mouse and Christmas Black kill people all over the place. Every place E.Z. goes, there's a body or two or three, you know, and they would kill them, you know. And that's okay, you know, that's all right. But there are other things that happen in life, you know. You're much more likely going to have sex with somebody than kill them. Much more likely in life. And I hope that's true. You know, I would hate to be in a room full of people who had more murders than they had sexual experiences in their lives. You know, this would not be I would leave.
Well, don't anybody leave. I want to open it up to questions in just a second, but you're here, so I have to ask you about some of this stuff.
Okay.
Barack Obama.
Your
thoughts, feelings? I mean, I've read a lot of your nonfiction, your political nonfiction.
Good. So you're warning me, right? Yeah.
So where do you fall on him? What do you tell us?
Well, you know, I mean, I think a lot of things. You know, kind of personally, I wonder about the experience level of Barack Obama. You know, it's like, but you know, I mean, Dick Cheney got all kind of experience. So like, experience alone do not a president make, you know. And don't make no mistake, Dick Cheney is our president. I take a step back. You know, the whole notion of a personality running us, the whole idea that it's a personality, this is black people's problem. We get a personality, they kill him. We get a personality, they kill him. They get a personality, they kill her. They get a personality, they get him a paternity suit, you know. Something happens, you know. If you have a leader, say, well, shit, all I got to do is get rid of the leader. So I think black people should withdraw from the Democratic Party. I think all of you should withdraw from the Democratic Party because you probably are all Democrats in here. But if you're in the Republican Party, withdraw from them too. Because, and I'm gonna say why, and then I'm going to get back to Barack Obama. I have a friend who just came back from Vietnam. And he's in Vietnam. You know, Vietnam, they keep memorials of the war. Like, for instance, you know, when a B-52, you know, bomb comes out of a B-52 bomber, the crater is about half the size of a football field. They've saved a few of those craters just to show you. You say, you see, they dropped 100,000 bombs this size on our country and that many bombs on Cambodia. So this is what they did. And then they have museums. And my friend was there. And, you know, I mean, I wouldn't even go. But my friend was there and he said, well, aren't you, like, a little angry at us? And, like, the Vietnamese, to a person, said, no, we're not angry at Americans. We're angry at your government. Now, Americans' response to this is said, well, we are the government. We vote. Well, the truth is, there's the Democrats and the Republicans. And if you think you have any control over either one of those people, you are, like, sad. We live in an oligarchy. The oligarchy is run by corporations and some very rich individuals. If Barack Obama becomes gets his power through the Democratic Party, he's beholden to them, and if he's beholden to him, he's beholden to the corporations. We should withdraw from the Democratic Party, vote for him anyway. And then it's not about Obama anymore, because it's not about Obama. It's about us. We went to Iraq. You people, you want to blame Bush. We went to Iraq. We paid the taxes. We're the American citizens. Our children went out there and are out there right now doing all these terrible things. So we have to make the choice. There is no way to make a choice within the system of the two-party system. It's an oligarchy. It's run by people who are beyond our control. If your only choice is to vote this way or that way, you know, only like 2% of the country votes anyway, we still get a president. How could you do that? He should be only a 2% president. You know what I mean? Or an 8% president. Not, I'm cautious because I don't want to get into this thing, well, he's going to be my hero. Number one, I would like him to live longer than that. Yeah. And number two, if he's my hero, he's bound to fail because heroes fail. You know, people who got a job work, you know.
So do you think there's any hope for the black voting bloc you were just talking about in maybe a parliamentary system like you were advocating in your book?
I would really love it, you know. And all I can do is to keep on talking about it, you know. I mean, I've actually hired a very good young black political activist from D.C. to help me to do an internet thing around the country where I'm going to, you know, try to convince people. I say, listen, we need to withdraw. We need to have, you know, a series of, you know, eight, you know, become like the, you know, National Rifle Association. We have eight things that are important, and we vote for those things. Now, if Barack Obama falls in that, we vote for Barack Obama. You know, he could say, well, listen, I'm looking for the Democrats and I'm looking for the black vote. You know, but I think angry young white men and old people and real Republicans, everybody should withdraw from these stupid parties because these people, you know, they don't care about us.
It's
funny, they care about their money.
Somebody else was here and said the same thing, who's coming from the other end of the political spectrum than you are. Lou Dobbs was here, and he said everybody ought to just pull out.
Oh, yeah.
You ought to be an independent and then make them work for you.
Absolutely, because that's the thing. We don't have a real country. Yeah, and the truth is, all poor people have the same issues. Once you get down to it, you say, well, I hate you, nigger. You say, I know you hate me, honky, but Do you love your children?
Why, yes, I love my children. Me too. So don't you think they should get lunch and an education? Well, yes, but I don't want to be educated with you. Well, then don't live in my neighborhood. That's all right. Live somewhere else. We don't have to like each other, but we need to have that money to pay for our old people, to pay for our young people, to pay for our lives. We need to be able to retire. We need to be able to build a country, but you can't own a house. How can that be? We live in a country where you can't dig your own grave or pick your own fruit. Now, that's pretty bad. And we vilify the people who do it for us. So, well, those are illegals. Man, shit, they're super legal as far as I'm concerned. You know how much a strawberry would cost you if we had to pick them? Can you see you out there saying, well, okay, now I'd spend $15 an hour. And what about my medical insurance? And I only work 7.5 hours a day. And I need toilet facilities and, you know. I said, oh, and can you feed me lunch? I said, damn, this one strawberry costs $3. It costs $3.
I know you're joking, but you think we're pretty spoiled as a culture.
Yeah.
Black, white.
I'm not joking. I mean, it's funny.
No, I mean, you're sort of mocking, but I mean, all of us, regardless of race, color, creed, et cetera, we're pretty spoiled. And
oh, my God. And, you know, and then you live in a black, you know, I'm writing a science fiction book right now, and these aliens are coming to Earth, and they're going to invade, and they wanted to work with Earthlings, but Earthlings are the only one Earth person. Is this young black guy who wanted to help these things, and so they're working with other animals, like porpoises, canaries, and ants. But one of them is working with human beings, and this one guy is a black guy, and so he keeps on, you know, recruiting his friends to join in with the aliens. But the only people he knows are black people, and so, like, in the end, the only people who connects the human race to the aliens are these black people, because they don't know any white people, you know, to talk about. This becomes a problem also. It's a problem that we have, the inability for black people to speak up, you know, when they get something and say, well, you know, I could be here, but, you know, I'm worried about the brothers. And, you know, most of us, once we make it, don't do it. I say, well, yeah, you know, man, I got my shit. You know, I had to work hard. I can't, you know, jeopardize what I got to help you. I said, well, man, you ain't got nothing if you're not helping me. Don't you get that?
Well, how do you sell that? How do you convince people of that?
I don't know. You know, one thing is by example. I keep publishing with Black Classic Press. I went to a party, Nation Magazine gave a party. You know, Nation Magazine, very progressive, very wonderful people. I went to the party a year ago. And Jonathan Kozol was standing in front of the audience, and Jonathan says, schools are more segregated now than they were in 1968. That's cool. New York schools are more segregated than the other schools in the country. I believe that. But you know how you expect, you know what he's going to say next? He said, the only thing more segregated than the schools in New York is this room. There's 1,000 people, 991 of them were white. And he didn't say it. And so afterwards, I went up to the publisher, a wonderful woman, Katrina Vandenhoof. I said, Katrina, we got to do something about this. And she said, you know, you're right. We have to start having meetings on it. And for the last year, we've been doing it. Not to get more black people in there, but to change the culture of the magazine. Yeah. And to work larger. And it's a very big problem. I don't know the answer. It's a really hard thing to do. But, you know, to be able to say that, I mean, you know, we have to be working. I mean, black people understand America better than anybody else. We're the group that's been here the longest, believe me. And we know why other people hate us. And we can speak that language. And to stay quiet, to vilify our children for, you know, wearing Nike tennis shoes that we make, becomes so unbecoming of us. You know? And so there's a lot of, you know, anyway, I answer your question. Obama, fine, but I'm not going to vote for him as a Democrat.
Okay, you know what? Let's end it there and bring you into the conversation. Thank you, Walter.
Here's a question.
But you know what? Let me call on folks. Folks, the way, just so you know, the way this will work is that hold your hand up and we will try to get a mic to you. And we'll start with the lady right in front here, please. Ma'am, could you wait for the mic, please?
Thank you. My question is, how soon will we get another E.Z. Rollins book?
What are you applauding for back here? The next one is called Blonde Faith. I finished it. I think it's coming out in September. That's what I think. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Another question right in front.
Lamont.
Lamont.
Mr. Steptoe.
Yes. I just wanted to point out that a work of fiction that did have a very powerful effect on the nation was Uncle Tom's Cabin, because Lincoln said to her when he met Harriet Beecher Stowe, "So you're the little woman who started this great big war." So fiction can have that kind of power.
Yeah.
Right here in the red.
She's going somewhere else.
Just one small question.
Small?
Yes. What gave you the idea for The Man in My Basement?
Oh, yeah. Man in My Basement is funny. First, it was a joke. The joke was, you know, somebody said, you know, so what does every black man in America need? Because, you know, black men in America, you know, I mean, really, I'm one of the only people who write about black male heroes. Still, I'm one of the only people who write about heroes that people can name. So, oh, man, did you hear about that mouse? Man, so, Easy Rollins, Socrates Fortlow. I mean, really, you know, and I'm not trying to toot a horn. I'm just saying it's like people, even black people, have problems articulating black male heroes because of the culture of America and how anti-black male it is. Somebody asked me once, they said, wait, what does every black man in America need? I said, well, he needs a white man locked up in his basement. So, you know, when he doesn't get the promotion, instead of going crazy and shooting everybody, he could go down and say, man, why didn't I get the promotion? And he said, well, did you go golfing with him? Golfing, man, we're in a plumbing company. I know how to golf. So, well, you know, if you want to make it, you got to learn how to, you know, to play his game. You know, and then, you know, from there, you know, it kind of grew into that notion of, because I think that, you know, the problem that you have with Blakey in that book is that you have a lot of black people who don't understand the world that they live in, and that we need an education. We need to be told, to be shown who we are, what our history is, what our future is. And talking, you know, to the evil white man in the basement helped him not really learn it, but get closer to it. You know, it was that was the notion, you know, the joke and then the reality. Also, you know, I've always thought that, you know, I mean, the bad thing about prison, we all know, is, you know, that, well, most of the people in here, if you're black, have somebody there. The good thing about prison is if you only had, like, your own little cell and you couldn't do anything else, imagine all the books you could read. You know, it's like, wow, cool. Yeah, give me some gruel. Okay, and let me read, you know, War and Peace. Wow, cool. Anything else?
Next question. Right in the middle there, gentleman with his hand
right
up.
Right in the middle, yes.
Sir, right. Keep your hand up, please. We'll get a mic to you. Thank you.
He's getting the mic to you. He should have like a boom.
Yeah, I know. It's a problem. That's why we're building a new library.
Thanks.
You're building new libraries?
Nice. Yeah, I was wondering whether you're familiar with the work of that French writer, Welbeck, who's written sort of very pornographic, innocence novels. And if so, could you compare the critical response that he's enjoyed compared to the response to your last book?
Okay, to start off, I haven't read Welbeck, so I mean that's to begin with. I am aware of that, and you know, the comparison is that, you know, that it's an interesting thing. I have a problem, you know, because I'm in between things. People, you know, like people in the literary, you know, literary world say, well, you're a popular writer, and so, you know, you're not a serious writer. People in the popular world says, well, you know, you're a literary writer, so, you know, you just think you're better than we are, you know. And on top of that, you know, being black, unashamedly black in America, and writing about black male heroes has caused a lot of times that the reviews get skewed. And so I think that I haven't been, I think I've been as well accepted, but in a negative, you know? You know, because really, the New York Times and the Daily Times is giving me a review. I mean, I'm getting reviews everywhere. They all hate it, but I'm getting reviews everywhere. Now, and I think that that's a good thing, because I think that a lot of readers, people who read, think, and they look at this and they say, well, it looks, because, you know, look, when people review my mysteries, it's the worst. I get, you know, 5-star reviews. Everybody loves it. It's great, you know, because it's, you know, they can put it in its box. But they always have the slug line, get some history with your mystery. Yeah, I wouldn't buy a book that had a slug line like that, you know. And so I'm happy about the bad reviews, and I think ultimately they'll do me well. I don't always believe that any publicity is good. In this case, I'm kind of happy with, even though they drive me crazy with the stupidity of them.
Gentleman right here.
The question is, how do you establish a writer's guild for black budding writers to get published or assist younger writers that are coming out to get their works published?
Uh-huh. Now, that's an interesting question. And I think it's a question that let me try to understand it. You know, black people buy more books than any other group in America. But that's because they consider Jews white. You know, if you separated Jews out, probably black people and Jews buy the same amount of books. But that's a whole other thing. My mother's Jewish, you know, and I always tell them, people say, well, you're half white and half black. I said, no, I there's no white in me. Thank you very much. You can keep that.
I'm black, too.
Huh?
I said, then I'm black, too.
Well, you might not be white. you know, but...
Sorry.
But... You might be black, you know. It's easy to be black in America. Just find somebody, you know. Lamont's great, 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 great grandfather, you know, hung out in your neighborhood, you know. But the thing is this: if you're a young black writer and you write in street lit or hip hop lit or any of those kind of lits, you know, with the girls with the nice butts on the cover, you're gonna get published. You're going to be published good, you're going to sell a lot of books, and you're going to know a lot about publishing. Now, if you're a young literary writer, you're going to have a lot of trouble. You know? And so the thing is, it's not just a question of age and bringing people around because of their age and stuff like that. It's also a notion. I've written these stories called The Tempest Tales, which I don't need to go into them, but Paul Coates with Black Classic Press is going to publish them. And Paul said, Walter, we have an opportunity here. I'll publish your book, but then I'll get two or three other young black literary writers, and I will... Put them in the pipeline. So right after your book comes out, then you know a couple of other books come out, and then maybe you can write another one. You know, whatever. And I think that that's how I'm answering it, and that's what Paul is doing for those young Afro-American, African-American, black literary writers. But for as far as popular writers among black people, man, they kicking ass. You know, they're doing good. I'm happy for it.
Were you asking specifically if there was a foundation or some sort of thing to follow?
Does one
carry
exist?
People along?
Well, it doesn't really need to right now because the publishing industry is dying to find these people. They're looking for them. If you are a young black writer and self-publishing and selling on the streets of Brooklyn, Simon & Schuster is going to find you, pick you up, and pull you in. You know. Other than that, there are agents and other groups of people trying to do it. But I don't think there's an institution other than Cave Canem. You know, which is the poetry organization, which really concentrates on helping. Cave Canem is a great organization, one of the best in American culture.
I thought you had started something for
Started a publishing institute at City College, just to get people of color involved in publishing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why don't we take a few more questions? Lady all with her hand up all the way in back, the black hat. Ma'am, if you can keep your hand up, please. Thank you.
Keep that hand up. You're so nice to come here and not be mad at me. I'm glad of that.
About 2 weeks ago, a hero came on our stage in America who happened to be black. His name was Wesley. I don't remember what his last name was.
Uh-huh.
Do you think we'll remember that hero in another couple of months?
Well, you know, he's an interesting hero, the guy in the subway, right? Well, you know, it's an interesting kind of hero, you know, because he's an American hero, you know. It's not a question of race. It's not a question of gender. This is a man who, you know, jumped up and went and saved, you know, somebody's life, or tried to save somebody's life. Maybe he did, maybe didn't, I don't know. But, you know, he put his own life at risk to help somebody. And I think that that's one kind of hero. One Kind of American Hero, which I would never denigrate. I think it's a wonderful thing. I think he's a wonderful guy. You know, I look at him, you know, as I often do and think, damn, I wouldn't have done that. You know, I'm glad there's somebody in the world who would do something like that. But black male heroes is another question. Black male heroes are those black men who know who they are, who work within our society and our culture to make ourselves better. The men who raise children, the men who work hard to make sure that their mothers are, you know, are safe and can live their lives. The people who go out on the street and sweep up the sidewalk in front of their house and, you know, and go over and help their neighbors. The kind of people who are heroes in their blackness, in our community. And so, not saying anything about, you know, Wesley, you know, not, you know, anything insulting about him. That's another kind of hero, which is, you know, which somehow, you know, a lot of people can say, I'm going to pay attention to that man. And then they lose E.Z. Rollins, Socrates Fortlow, Raymond Alexander, Jackson Blue. You know, there's a whole bunch of people who, you know, I write about who actually exist in our communities. These are people who are living and helping and working with us. You know, the idea is so it's a little, again, not trying to attack him. You know, he'll be remembered. You know, it's all, you know, kind of momentary heroes are remembered, white, black, you know, Hispanic, male, female. But to celebrate the heroism of black men in America, I mean, just surviving in America, nobody's doing that. And that's from, we aren't doing it.
Another question right here on the aisle, lady in the red.
It's a nice phone.
Are we going to have any further adventures of Socrates Fortlow, which is by far one of my favorite?
Yeah, you know, I had this great thing that happened lately. Skip Gates called me from Harvard, and he said they were giving this you know, series. Every year they give these series of three lectures, the Alain Locke lectures. Alain Locke's the first major black philosopher in America. And he said, Walter, I want you to come up and give a three-day speech in a philosophy. I went, damn. And I said, okay, you know, because you can't say no to something like that. So I said, well, but, you know, to give speeches, you know, they're so dry. You know the negation of the negation, and you know all that, you know, kind of stuff. You know, I studied that stuff. You know, I know that stuff, but it's really boring. And so I decided I would write three Socrates Fortlow stories, and you know, and the new Socrates Fortlow stories is Socrates actually starting his university. He gets a house, and he gets it without killing anybody. And he brings all the people together, members of gangs, community activists, gamblers, children. You know, he even, you know, gets a little love interest up in there, you know. And I wrote the first four stories. I read three of them at Harvard, which is fun. People like it. They say, thank you, Mr. Mosey. It was not so boring, you know. And I think in the next maybe 2 years I'll publish them somewhere. Yeah.
I think we'll look forward to those stories. Please join us upstairs. And thank you, Walter Mosley.
Thank you. Thank you. I was okay. I kept you from asking the 10 questions.
It's okay. It's okay. I didn't ask you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.